Hey, Internet, this is Eric M. Hunter, and this is Hashtag Radio.
Hashtag Radio.
Sega.
You're listening to Hashtag Radio right here. I am Eric M. Hunter, and welcome to what could possibly be a special edition of the podcast. That's right. This is something that I've been wanting to talk about for a long time now, and it couldn't be a better time for the 20th anniversary of one of my favorite console releases. That's right. It's the Sega Dreamcast. So come along on the journey with me while I tell you about my interaction with the console, the love that I grew from it, and its historical landmark in gaming history. Let's get started.
This is the day you have trained for, the day you have studied for. Utilize your superior skills, your superior intelligence.
Sit down, rodent.
Oh,
Sarah, baby.
Oh, you were one.
Don't make me hurt you.
Learn to defeat your ruthless enemy, Steve of Hackensack.
Ryan, you're gonna get roofed.
Shut up, quadruped.
September 9th, 1999 was the Sega Dreamcast release date here in North America. The first time I came in contact with the Sega Dreamcast was through advertisements, seeing them on TV and popular gaming magazines that I had subscriptions to, such as GamePro and Electronic Gambling Monthly, or EGM. Growing up, I was a Nintendo kid through and through. The very first legit home console I've ever played was the Nintendo Entertainment System, and that ballooned into the Super Nintendo. And then Sega kind of came into our household mainly because it was on the cheap. We picked up a Sega Genesis console for half of what it was when it was first released. And the one game that kind of stuck out for us even wanting the console was Mortal Kombat. My brother and I were huge fans of the Mortal Kombat arcade machine when it was first released back, I want to say, in 93. And it was, for whatever reason, we felt like this was our game. This was our generation's fighter. You couldn't get away from it. It was everywhere. It was in every arcade. It was in every magazine. It was on the news for the infamous Joe Lieberman trying to squash violent video games and blah blah blah, which history proves to create, you know, the MSRB and things of that nature. So when we found out that the Genesis version of Mortal Kombat had all of the fatalities that the arcade did, had the blood that the arcade did, we needed the Genesis version. And of course, that was just, you know, the taste of what the Genesis gave us. We dived deep into Sonic the Hedgehog, especially Sonic 3. We would play the multiplayer game constantly. Going back and looking at it now, the game is kind of half-ass. Although, you know, for a kid, it was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed it. I fell deeply in love with Jerry Glanville's Pigskin Foot Brawl. This is a game that I talk about all the time. It is a medieval football game that, rather than tackling the ball and trying to knock the ball out of your opponent's hand, you kill them with swords and hang them with ropes. It's a game I still play today. I actually played it a couple of weeks ago. It's just a super silly kind of Mutant League football style game. Just love the aesthetics. It was amazing beat-em-ups on the console, like Streets of Rage. My brother and I played the heck out of Final Fight solo and then Final Fight 2 cooperatively. Having a game like Streets of Rage, I want to believe that Child Eric knew the importance that was the Streets of Rage series on the Sega Genesis. I want to feel like I didn't take it for granted. I didn't take the music for granted, or the visuals, or just the sheer awesomeness of beat-em-up action. I probably did, but boy, do I appreciate it now. Final Fight and Final Fight 2 especially are still one of the greatest games of all time. One that I think back on fondly now and again. And one is probably ready to be played by me again. When it came to Sega, that was pretty much it. We didn't really move on to the Sega Saturn. We, you know, especially with EGM magazine, they were really big on trying to showcase as many consoles as possible. So, like, we saw stuff from the Atari Jaguar. We were reading previews on the 3DO. I would like to say that we were tapped into the market. But for whatever reason, either, you know, due to money or just constraints, we never had a Sega Saturn. I personally didn't own a Sega Saturn until maybe 5 or 6 years ago when I picked one up. In our household, Sega kind of started and ended with the Sega Genesis. And that was until the announcement of the Sega Dreamcast. There was something about this console on paper that just seemed so leaps and bounds above its time and all of the competitors out there. And even looking back on it now, Sega did some revolutionary stuff for a console that paved the way for how we interact with consoles today. It wasn't just for playing games. They had all sorts of plans for online media and movies and just different ways of interacting with your console rather than through a controller. There was a keyboard, there was a mouse, there was a light gun. We'll talk more about that in a minute. And I remember watching the commercials and thinking, wow, this thing looks really cool. So I would have been 14, almost 15 at the time. So I was at that age. I was on the cusp of high school, if not already in high school. I was coming into my own. I was struggling with trying to find out who I was as a person, trying to find that identity of who Eric Hunter was. I was listening to a lot of heavy metal music, and I was kind of going through that goth phase. And I was introduced to theater, which is something that I still attend to, really building my personality around. Theater was something that I had never even considered before that time, but right when I was in the eighth grade and going into as a freshman in high school, my brother, who's 3 years older than me, had been in numerous plays in high school of all different sorts, including, you know, like The King and I and The Wizard of Oz. And I always envied him being up on that stage to have that courage to go up there and, you know, remember all of those lines and all of that blocking and the interaction with everything and all the late nights he had to do in the school. Like, I envied that stuff, you know. It felt like he was something bigger. And I made a point of that to kind of go outside my boundaries when I finally made it to high school. And I did. I joined the theater group and I was in a lot of musicals and plays and stuff. It was a great time in my life. And when this console got announced, for whatever reason, I felt like it was geared exactly towards me. It was cutting edge. It was neat looking. They were trying to go 110% with this release. The first time that I actually touched a Sega Dreamcast was at my local Blockbuster at one of those kiosks that was set up, which was basically just a sheet metal box with, you know, plexiglass in front of a, you know, a Fat Betty tube TV with all of the cords and consoles, like, you know, locked under lock and key. And there was always that weird film. There was always that weird film on the controller. It felt like kind of like a hard waxy feel. Like it's like if it got worn too much, it would start to stick to your hands. I'm assuming that was just something they did for the retail because there were so many kids that were going to be playing with it. But when I first saw that at my local Blockbuster, I actually waited in line behind another group of kids just to be able to play Sonic Adventure. Now, say what you will about Sonic Adventure, this was the first time that Sonic stepped into 3D. And we'd seen the ups and downs with that. We saw the ups and downs with Mario 64, Castlevania, The Legend of Zelda. There's a lot of hits and misses there. But this was Sonic. Sonic was known for speed. And man, when you played that first level, that beach level, for the first time, it was hard not to say that Sonic was the fastest thing in video games. I still remember the sensation, the goosebumps, just the chills. I'm thinking about it now. When you get on that first ramp and you're running and the camera turns in front of you and looks to view behind you and that giant killer whale comes crashing through, destroying the bridge. It's amazing. Regardless of what happened to the game after that, that first level was leaps and bounds above what I could even possibly imagine what a console was capable of. I was that kid that would play that game and see footage of that game and think games cannot get any better than this. There is no way that a game could look or play as good as Sonic Adventure. Now, call that, you know, naivety or being optimistic about something that I really enjoyed, so I was giving it the benefit of the doubt. But still, when I saw the Xbox 360 for the first time, or saw the PlayStation 3 being, you know, rendering real-time graphics, I thought to myself then, there's no way that these could get any better. How silly I was. So unfortunately, I didn't get the console right out the gate. My birthday falls on Halloween, which was just a little month and a half after the release of the Sega Dreamcast, and I made sure that my mom and dad knew exactly what I wanted for my birthday. And that was the Sega Dreamcast. And I was lucky enough, I was fortunate enough to get a kind of a pretty good hefty load of games. If you go back and look at the launch lineup of games for the Sega Dreamcast, I don't think there was a better list of titles to come out on a new console's release. Impossible. There was a total of 18 games, and of those 18, these are the ones that I got. Mortal Kombat Gold. Mortal Kombat Gold. Again, one of the first times that Mortal Kombat had jumped into the 3D world with Mortal Kombat 4 that was released on the PlayStation and the N64. Oh gosh, the N64 version of that game. Ugh. It was like playing in a completely different realm. Now sure, there was other 3D fighters that I've played, like Virtual Fighter, Battle Arena, Toshinden, Tekken. There were 3D fighters already, but there was something about Mortal Kombat that kind of opened the door of what was really possible. Again, say what you will about this game, but when you saw that Mortal Kombat 4 was coming to the Sega Dreamcast with added characters, not only did you get the original lineup, you got Katana, Melina, Cyrax, Kung Lao, Baraka, and they even had Sektor as a hidden character in this game. It literally was Mortal Kombat 4 New Game Plus. And it still is only available on the Sega Dreamcast. Mortal Kombat Gold has never been released at the time of this recording on any other console. And to me, that's amazing. Being a big Kung Lao fan, being a big Baraka fan, and a game that I was already familiar with, albeit not very good, how could I not have Mortal Kombat Gold? Soul Calibur. Soul Calibur was a game and a game franchise I had no idea about. I didn't know it was part of the Soul Edge series. I didn't know anything about this game. But when I picked this game up and played it for the first time, that single player campaign mode is still one of the best game modes in any fighter I have ever played. It did something different that you weren't expecting. The game played kind of like it was a set of mini games, like mini challenges that you had to beat your opponents under certain circumstances or within a certain time frame or with certain characters. And then you journeyed across this map and it told the story of your character. I mean, I've played other Soul Calibur games, but this one, for whatever reason, it still sticks in my mind as being the best in the series. Sonic Adventure, I mentioned before. How could you not buy a Sega console and not own a Sonic game with it? Other than, you know, the Saturn, because there was no Sonic game. Good job, Sega. Again, it's Sonic. You can't not enjoy a Sonic game. Now, of course, it gets very tedious, and there's a lot of parts of the game that are practically broken, but initially, when you first played this game, I was awestruck by what they have done with Sonic. It was so good. House of the Dead 2. I am still a huge fan of rail shooters, especially when it comes to light guns. It just reminds me of a time when me and my brother would go into the dark, seedy corners of our local arcade, hearing all the sounds and seeing all the lights and all the cabinet art, all of that stuff in the marquee. It brings back this nostalgia that will never be replaced. Just getting those goosebumps of, I've got $10 and quarters in my pocket, and I can play any of the games in here that I want. But House of the Dead 2, I'm just such a big fan of like horror and macabre. Still to this day, it's some of the stuff that I really enjoy reading about and watching and just ingesting. And being able to just, you know, take down zombies, what's not to love when it comes to something like that? And when it was announced that it was coming as a launch title for the Sega Dreamcast, how could I not have this game? Now, one strange thing was the light gun that was made for the Sega Dreamcast is actually made by Mad Catz. Sega and a lot of other game developers and publishers at the time took a step back from making this style of peripheral because the Columbine school shooting had just happened not that long ago, still fresh in our minds, and they wanted to kind of separate themselves as much as possible. So the actual light gun for the Dreamcast by Mad Catz, it doesn't look like a gun. It looks more like now that I think about it, it kind of looks like the Needler from Halo. Like, it kind of comes back onto your arm where the VMU goes. It was a fine light gun. It had auto fire on it, auto reload, all that stuff. The light gun was great. I enjoyed the light gun. But just being able to play that game at home without having to pop in 50 cents every time you lost a life. Like, that's... for me, it was amazing. Still, to this day, one of my favorite games of all time, House of the Dead 2. NFL 2K. Now, I'm not that big of a sports guy. I mean, I enjoy baseball, I enjoy watching sports, I enjoy playing sports, but when it comes to, like, knowing stats or who plays for what team and that kind of stuff, as far as when it goes to, like, fantasy football, that's pretty much where I put an end to it. But there was something about this game that really stuck out to me. Obviously, to me, it looked lifelike. All of, like, the touchdown sequences and just watching the players throw the ball and the receivers catch it, like, it looked like I was watching a game on the TV. Again, I felt like the graphics couldn't get any better than this. And the other thing that I remember was right around when this game was about to be released, there was a lot of hubbub with them, the NFL, and Electronic Arts about certain rights and who was allowed to make sports games and who wasn't allowed to make sports games. Like, this is when, like, that conversation really started to kind of get going. And there was something about wanting to stick it to EA. Even at that young of an age, I didn't like EA. And wanting to stick with the Sega Sports Network games. And if I had to sit down and pick a football game that I would say this is my favorite football game from my childhood, it would be this game. And at a very close second, it would be Madden 64. And again, it was just because it was available to me. It was one of the games that I just happened to put a lot of time into. The game had been created to a point where it was a lot more accessible for somebody who wasn't that good at games, like sports games like this. And, I mean, it was fun to play. I got good enough at it that I would be able to beat my brother. I'd be able to beat my friends. So, it felt like it was an easy pickup. Ready to Rumble. Man, Ready to Rumble. For whatever reason, I didn't think there was any other boxing games other than Mike Tyson's Punch-Out or the later Punch-Out for the Nintendo. Didn't know anything about Evander Holyfield's game or Buster Douglas for the Genesis. None of that. I just, again, boxing is a sport that I don't really get into. So when I saw anything about, like, realistic boxing, I kind of stepped away. But man, Ready to Rumble Boxing. The boxers in this game are so creative. They're just so wacky and goofy. And I'm remembering now there was, like, those stupid little Easter eggs where if you turn the console on Halloween, there'd be ghosts and witches and stuff that are sitting in the audience. And then the same thing would happen on Christmas. You'd see Santa and, like, reindeer and elves, I think. The game, to me, felt like it was easy and very approachable, but yet there was a underlying game mechanics that took a while to master to really get those combos and stuff down. The visuals, the aesthetics, just everything about Ready to Rumble shouted Punch Out to me. So I had to have this game. One game that I picked up later that I'm going to set here as an honorable mention just because I know a lot of you are clamoring out there wanting to know where this game is. Shenmue was a game that when I was introduced to it, I feel like it was too young for it. I couldn't wrap my mind around it. I understand its importance, especially now, and it's a game that I've played through in the past 10 years, and I enjoyed playing it. But man, when it got launched, it just didn't seem like the game for me. I didn't put a lot of time into it, but I know it's got its fan base, and it's just not a game for me. There's a lot of things about the Sega Dreamcast that kind of spoke to me, and a lot of it is mainly just due to advertising and just kind of gimmicky things. For instance, the base OS for the Sega Dreamcast was Windows CE. Now, Windows, of course, Windows PCs and Windows computers, Windows 95, 98. Like, I was extremely familiar with that. I was very good with computers at the time. I was already at this age, I was building websites with HTML and Notepad. I had a couple of fan sites that I wish I still had available to me, but I made an entire fan site about Banjo-Kazooie and Banjo-Tooie, included walkthroughs and pictures and item descriptions and all that stuff. And I wish I had all that stuff still, but I've gone on the Wayback Machine and that stuff just isn't there. But yeah, Windows CE, like how weird is that? Like this thing is an actual computer. That's what I thought. Like this thing actually is an actual computer. That means I could basically do anything. I mean, in the box of the Dreamcast came a browser disk. So you could browse the web, which was mind-boggling. This thing had an adapter on it. Like it had a dial-up modem, a 56K baud modem that you could literally plug into your phone jack and hop online and check your email or search for the hottest Sega news. Like, nothing like that had come anywhere near what the other gaming consoles were talking about. There was a lot of like rumblings, like, and we later come to find out like the Sony PlayStation 2 had a broadband adapter, had the ability to play DVDs. Like that, Sony was also looking outside the box when it came to a home console, other than just thinking about playing games. But for whatever reason, like reading the specs on this for me was just like, again, it can't get any better than this, you know? Like it spoke to me personally. And when I saw things like what would now become more like a novelty was the memory card. Game consoles didn't have hard drives back in the day. They had no memory whatsoever. You had to buy a card to save your game. And again, Sega did something different that the other consoles didn't do and haven't done since. And I guess there's no reason for it now because you got hard drives. But the VMU, the Visual Memory Unit, was about half the size of a credit card and about a half an inch thick. And it had an actual LCD screen on it, or LED screen, LCD, it's probably LCD. With a directional pad and two buttons. And not only would this thing save your games so you could take it to your friend's house, but it actually had games on it. This was on the tail end of the Tamagotchi, or the Pocket Pet. And for Sonic Adventure specifically, your chows could be transferred to your VMU, and you could, you know, take your VMU with you so you could feed them and play with them and, you know, keep them happy. Something that I did. I totally took my VMU to school to show it off to my friends and see how cool it was. The other thing that they said that they were going to do, which I don't think they ever did, was in a game like NFL 2K. Where if you're playing with somebody and you're choosing your plays, you can obviously see what your other player is going to pick in terms of plays. And then you can kind of pick a defense or an offense that would counteract that. But with the VMU, the idea would be is you would actually pick the play on the VMU so that the person you're playing couldn't see it. What? Huge! Like that was such a mind-boggling idea. Even for somebody who didn't really regularly play sports games, I recognized how important that would be in terms of the competitive nature of playing a sports game like football on a home console against somebody. And with that, I mean, like I was saying before, with the online play, Quake 3 Arena was probably the first game I ever played online, and it was through my Sega Dreamcast. It even had a strain. I've talked about this before, but there for a while there, because Quake 3 Arena was on the PC, you could actually play against PC players in the same game. You were at a little bit of a disadvantage, obviously, because you were playing on a single joystick controller while they were using mouse and keyboard. But again, that all changed when Sega released the mouse and keyboard for the Sega Dreamcast, something that I have in my possession now and I thoroughly love. It's just a dumb keyboard and mouse that has the Sega Dreamcast logo on it, but for whatever reason, like what that thing stood for was mind-boggling. You know, again, something that nobody had ever done before. They were taking these leaps and they were running with them. They were willing to try anything. And we got a whole bunch of weird peripherals. I already mentioned the light gun, the mouse and keyboard. There was a fishing reel for the it's not Bass Pro Fishing. I can't remember the name of the game now, but it was just a fishing game, and it looked like a fishing reel that you'd reel in when you caught a fish on the line. Just so, I mean, it's just dumb. It's just dumb stuff that, I mean, until the Nintendo Wii, you didn't really see that much, you know, like Sega was all in, and I guess they kind of had to, especially with the downfall of the Sega Saturn. And again, one of the things that I wish I still had, I subscribed to the Sega Dreamcast magazine. This magazine was short-lived. It only released, I think, maybe 12 to 16 issues. But each issue came with a Dreamcast disc on it that had a bunch of demos and videos of new games that were coming out. Again, perfect marketing scheme. Like, before the internet was the internet today, they had to figure out a way for to get games in the hands of their gamers, and this is just how it worked. You know, the Dreamcast magazine was titled the official Dreamcast magazine, because I'm assuming there was an unofficial. Was very much like Nintendo Power. All of the reviews and previews were very slighted for Sega. They were very kind about everything, but there was a lot of in-depth reviews, very cool previews and all that stuff. The Dreamcast magazine was actually when the first time that I read that they were going to stop the production of the Dreamcast and Sega was going to sell off all of their hardware division. Like, that was heartbreaking to me. But yeah, this console, you know, it had the four player ports so you could play multiplayer. The controller was weird and goofy, but it felt pretty good in your hands. Had an excellent D-pad. The triggers were a little weird. The VMU kind of threw off where the cable would go. There was actually a spot in the back of the controller towards the top where you could clip the cable in because it fed from the bottom, to push it towards the top so your hands wouldn't get in the way of it. That was a little weird. Now, of course, one of the best things about any console, or the only thing about any console, if it's going to make or break, it's about the games. There were so many radical games that came out and so many genres for the Sega Dreamcast. It was hard not to find ones that you really enjoyed. I've already talked about NFL 2K. Again, big fan of that game. Virtual Tennis, another arcade game that I played a ton of because it was so easy just to step in and start playing. It was only like, I think, like a two, maybe a three button game. And then again, being able to play that on a home console was unheard of. And it was so lifelike to the arcade that it was kind of, again, unbelievable. Worms World Party. Worms went through my high school. Like, I mean, it was gasoline on a fire. It was there. It wasn't there one day, and then it was on. It was installed on every computer the next. There was something about Worms, again, when it comes to the simplicity of the gameplay and the how approachable the game was. But there were those kids that, like, for whatever reason, like, you didn't want to play them because they were so good. But man, Worms was just one of those party games, those multiplayer games that you don't get that rush of playing anymore. Phantasy Star Online, another game that I didn't really get into until after the demise of the Dreamcast. And again, it's kind of funny because they just announced that it was going to be re-released for the first time. And I mean, since the game was released initially on the Dreamcast back in 2000. Phantasy Star, I have a love-hate relationship with. I had a lot of time built into some of the Sega games, some of the Genesis games, specifically Phantasy Star 3 and 4. Those were kind of like the games that kind of took my fancy when I was playing them. Again, bringing a franchise into 3D is never an easy thing to do on top of making it online for you to play with other people. It kind of changed up. One of the things I really enjoy about RPGs is turn-based action. I've never really been big on action RPG games, with the exception of a couple here and there. So it was a game that I played, but, you know, it just really wasn't for me. Typing of the Dead. Gosh, this game was so dumb and so great. Who would have thought just bringing a game to... Because, again, like, when I was in school, like, teaching typing on a computer was... I mean, that was something we did in, like, the third grade, the second grade. Like, and all through high school. Like, I had typing classes, computer classes, like, basic computer classes pretty much through my educational career. And we had all kinds of, like, really goofy typing games, and Mavis Beacon teaches typing, and We had a couple of like weird sci-fi alien spaceship typing games that I can't remember the names of. Math Munchers, stuff like that. But being able to play like a legit hardcore arcade shoot 'em up game with your keyboard, again, like, come on, man, that's amazing. Like, you would never hear that. And then they re-released it, and then they did a new version that was released on Steam not that long ago. Like, there are groups of people who, you know, who buy into that niche idea, man, and it sells. Like, it, as goofy as it sounds, like, it sells. Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. Oh, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater to me is one of those game franchises that whichever of the first that you played in the series is always going to be your favorite, and you will always deem it as the best. For me, it's the first one. Me and a friend of mine in high school, this was literally the only game that we would play, and we only played it on the Sega Dreamcast. There had been times where I'd come over his house with this game and a couple of more that we'll talk about in a minute, but there was just something about collecting those tapes and finding the letters for the skate. Again, a skateboarding game, something the likes that I personally had no experience with the exception of, ooh, gosh, Skate or Die on the NES or 720 in the arcade. The games weren't bad, but the learning curve and the finesse to play the game and have fun with it was so high that as a kid, I didn't have the time to dedicate to go in and to really learn the mechanics. There was just too many other games. There's too many other things to do, you know? And Skate or Die is a perfect example of that. It's a game that, when I look back on it now, it's like, oh man, this game is kind of a technical marvel. Like, there wasn't anything like it, and they went out to try to do something really interesting, and I feel like they pulled it off as best they can. I just couldn't get into it. But when Tony Hawk's Pro Skater came out, I mean, it was a game that I stayed up hour after hour, night after night, you know, asking my mom not to go to school today because I got a game to play. Like, this Tony Hawk's Pro Skater was definitely one of those games. Man, Kiss Psycho Circus, The Nightmare Child. This game, I bought this game, not when it came out, but it wasn't that far after. And I don't even remember why I picked it up. Like, I guess I remember seeing screenshots of it in a magazine and thinking, like, man, this game is so gothic and creepy. Like, it's got to be great. And I remember playing it just a little bit and then, like, showing it to a couple of my friends, and they were just like, oh yeah, this just doesn't work out. And unfortunately, again, it goes back to, you know, like, you need something else. You can't just have a single stick to play a first person shooter anymore. You know, controls have evolved and changed so much over time that you get to a point finally where it's like, nope, this is it. Like, this is the way that you're supposed to do this. And it's just really about tweaking it and fine tuning it. But yeah, like, yeah, the artwork on the game was really cool, and I wasn't a big Kiss fan, but I just, you know, just the creepy vibes of it, I was like, no, this game's ripe for me. Frogger 2, Swampy's Revenge. So this is kind of an odd one for me. The Dreamcast that I own two different Dreamcast consoles, and neither of them are the one that I got for my birthday all those years ago. And the reason for that is I had spent the night at a friend's house, and I had brought my Dreamcast and all my games and controllers and stuff, and, you know, and clothes and that stuff. And the plan was we were going to be awake all night playing video games. And that's exactly what we did. And then the next morning, his parents were going to take me home. So we were on our way home, and I had everything in my backpack. And we stopped at a gas station. We got in, and I got like a soda and some snacks or something like that. Come back, and my backpack is gone. Just gone. His parents left the windows down and the doors unlocked, and I had just laid my backpack there on the seat, not thinking of anything because I was, you know, 14, 15 years old. What do I know? I remember going to the gas station's manager, store manager, and saying, like, hey, like, you need to check the cameras. Somebody stole my backpack, blah, blah, blah. And nothing came of it, of course, because I was a kid. Nobody cared about me being a kid. So I was obviously thoroughly depressed. A few years went by, and I was telling that story to a girlfriend that I was dating at the time. And I guess she just felt bad for me because that year, for my birthday, she bought me another Dreamcast. And a lot of the games that I had lost from that theft. And one of the games that her and I played was Frogger 2, Swampy's Revenge. Frogger 2 plays like you think it would play a Frogger game in a 3D world. It's still Frogger, but you can move around a little bit more, and there's more mini games and stuff. It's a dumb game. There's not a whole lot to it. But whatever reason, I have a fond memory of that because I felt like, oh, she did this very nice thing for me, and now we connect in this game. So she enjoyed playing it with me. There was a fun like two-player cooperative mode. So, you know, Frogger 2, not the greatest, but it definitely I have a place for it in my heart still.
Good morning. Welcome to the laboratory of Jean-Paul Gasset.
Seaman. Good grief, Seaman. Talk about weird peripherals. Which, again, isn't that weird nowadays, but a microphone with a game, being able to interact with this weird creature known as Seaman. So, again, it's so weird, but you know what got me? You know what got me on this game? That's right, man. Leonard Nimoy. Leonard Nimoy is the announcer for this game. And RIPD, now that he's gone, anytime I boot this game back up, which is usually about once a year, just to see how long I can go without like clawing my eyes out and turning it off. Because it is a dangerously slow game. I am always surprised, I guess you could say, when I'm greeted by Leonard Nimoy in a video game. Because again, maybe it's just dumb Eric, but I don't ever remember anything like that before. I don't ever remember hearing or seeing somebody who was famous being in a video game. I mean, I definitely read stories about, you know, actors and musicians and stuff about them playing games. It's like, oh, that's cool. Like Billy Joe from Green Day likes to bring his Game Boy on tour so he can play it during downtime. Like, oh, I play my Game Boy during downtime all the time, you know, but never did I think about having something like that in a video game. It was still just weird. Marvel versus Capcom 2. Man, oh man. Talk about playing the poop out of this game. That same friend that I tragically lost my original Dreamcast console with. We loved this game. There was a awful unlocking process when it came to trying to get all the new characters and the costumes and stuff. To which later what I would do is basically I purchased the Game Shark. Again, another weird peripheral to unlock everything with the Game Shark. You got points for everything you did in the game. So you got points for every time you had a match. You got points for every time you beat the game with a particular character. You take those points. There was a store in the game where you can go and buy new characters and levels and costumes and stuff. You could also get points by leaving the game for depending on how long you played the game. So how long the game ran. We would leave this thing running overnight just so we could get those free points to unlock those new characters and stuff. God, Marvel vs. Capcom 2. This game now retails still for like $60 or $70 or even upwards of $80, depending on the how complete the copy is. And I don't own the game anymore because I had to sell it to pay bills and stuff and rent back in the day. But yeah, man, Marvel vs. Capcom 2 was one of those games that I just thought was such a silly idea, mixing Marvel characters and, you know, Capcom characters together. They would never do anything like this again. Oh, how dumb I was. Man, oh man. Gauntlet Legends. Gauntlet Legends. This game was the game for me and my brother growing up. It was always an easy, hey, do you want to play a game? Sure, what do you want to play? Want to play Gauntlet Legends? This is the game that we play. We tried playing it in the arcade, but obviously we're terrible at it. And you die really quick. But man, there was something about this game. It's just that beat 'em up aesthetic. That is easy to be introduced to. It's easy to catch on to see what's going without really having to like bury into like the core mechanics of the game. Just a real easy pick up and play. Everybody's got their character. My character was the Green Jester, still is the Green Jester. His was the Blue Wizard. We still will quote each other like, the Blue Wizard needs food badly.
Warrior needs food badly.
So dumb, but man, that game is just, there's something about that. It's just dumb fun, I guess is the easiest way to explain it. It's just dumb fun. Again, a game that I always come back to anytime where it's like, you know what, today we're playing Dreamcast games. Gauntlet Legends. Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six. This was the first Rainbow Six game that I've ever played. I am not a fan of this game. I am very bad at this game, which is probably why I'm not a fan of it. I never cared to like having to like plot out where your guys are going to go. Before you actually play the game, not a big fan at all. But again, I feel like I understood the gravity that it was trying to do, that tactical shooter. To me, again, never seen anything like that on a console before. And it was revolutionary. And Tom Clancy was a name that I knew. I didn't know why. I remember his name being on like some movies. That was about it. Gosh, there was just, again, there's something about this game that when I picked it up, I tried my best to play it. I just could not wrap my head around it. Choo Choo Rocket. God, this game is so weird. It's been released a couple of times. I know on the GBA, I think they even released it on Steam. This is just a weird puzzle game, cat and mouse, trying to get the mice into your certain hole. There's a lot of multiplayer aspects to it. Unfortunately, this was not a hot game here at the Hunter household, so it was basically just me playing it by myself. I feel like this game, if I sat down and actually play it, it'd probably be one of my favorite puzzle games. Never could get into it, and being that young, again, there were so many other games to play. This is definitely a game that I needed to play through again. Resident Evil Code Veronica. Oh my god, this game. Resident Evil Code Veronica, I still feel is my Resident Evil game. I played Resident Evil 1 through 3 on the PlayStation, but when Code Veronica got announced for the Dreamcast, and it was a double disc game, again, I felt like this game was my Resident Evil game. I played it from start to finish multiple times. When I got the Game Shark, I played back through it again with all the crazy weapons and stuff already unlocked and ready to go, just to completely break the game. And it's a Resident Evil game that I haven't gone back to play again, basically since then. I think I got it on the GameCube now, so that'll probably be the version I would play, because I think there's like some updated control schemes and stuff. The story of this was so dark and terrifying that, again, I felt like it was made for me, being like into that horror stuff and that macabre stuff. Like, that's the Resident Evil Code Veronica is definitely a game I need to go back and play again. And another game that falls into the same vein, Legacy of Kain: Soul Reaver. Never heard of Legacy of Kain series. But this game, there was something about this game that when I was first introduced to it, again, either through like watching a TV commercial or flipping through a magazine, it spoke to me. It was something that was like, you need to play this game. Like, you've never played a story like this before. Like, it's so dark and it's so menacing and blah, blah, blah. And it's a really good 3D action adventure game. Again, a game I need to go back and play again. I feel like, gosh, I need to go back and play all these games again. It was doing things that I had never seen before, collecting the souls as for energy after the enemies you defeated, switching between like a light and dark world. It's got its flaws, but again, like a lot of these games, especially that were Dreamcast only games or started out only as Dreamcast games, there is that niche market, that niche group of players that, hands down will say that these are their games. And to me, Soul Reaver is definitely one of those games. One of the last games that I'll talk about that means something very personal to me, NFL Blitz 2000. There was something, this was like the wild, wild west when it came to football games. Because again, like this is when EA was like trying to push their way in to eat the NFL and all sports games, and that nobody could release a sports game. NFL Blitz, again, an arcade game that I first played, fast-paced action, made by one of the greatest developers of its time, Midway. Of Mortal Kombat fame. It was dirty. It was raw. It kind of reminded me of Pigskin Football, the Genesis game that I mentioned earlier. It was, like you were kind of punching people. There were late hits. There was no referee to throw penalties and flags and stuff. Didn't even have to kick field goals. Like you automatically just got the point if you opted to kick the field goal. There was a bunch of dumb like big head mode, and you could play as Raiden and Sub-Zero, and just there was the one play, and I'll never forget this. I had a very good friend of mine who loved playing this game but hated playing against me, because I would play the exact same play practically every time, and for whatever reason he couldn't play the right defense, or he didn't know what I was going to do, which was silly because I would literally play this every time. I think it was called the X cross play. Basically, what you would do is the quarterback would hike the ball and then lob it to like a linebacker or a running back or something like that. And then he would launch the ball to like the furthest end of the field, opposite of where he was standing. I ran this play all the time, to the part where he got so angry that when he finally got the ball, he traced back and fell back the 60 or 80 yards or whatever it was, so that he was sitting in his own end zone trying to avoid my players from tackling him, and then just ultimately, you know, was done with the game. Like, he just didn't want to play anymore. There's something about, like, those arcade-style games of that time that, again, was something that you just didn't see, you know? There were those games where it's like you felt like they were trying to take advantage of you. They were trying to squeeze as much money out of you as they could. And of course, it's an arcade game. That was their business model. That's how they did it. But there was also some of those games, NFL Blitz being one of those games, where it felt like we're going to give you as much action, fun, and play for 25 cents so that you'll want to play for 25 cents more. Not the, oh, you were almost there. If you just had one more life, you could get it. Or if you could have just your powers back, you would be able to beat this level. Like, it didn't feel that way. And I feel like there's a lot of those games at this time that kind of gave you that. So before we start winding down with some final thoughts, I just wanted to talk about kind of where the Dreamcast went after that. I'd mentioned before they released a broadband adapter that's next to impossible to find for any ideal price. The thing is crazy expensive, but it's a LAN adapter for high-speed internet, so that you could play and surf the net online for super fast. One of the things I missed was about the medium, the game media that you played. It was a disc, but it wasn't your traditional DVD or CDR. It was something right in between. It was called a GD-ROM or a GDR, which was a gigabit disc. It held almost a gigabit of data. That has been completely cracked, and actually not that long after. A lot of the games didn't even have a gig of data on them. It would have the game, which may have been 500 megabytes, and then there was garbage data, just, you know, letters and numbers and ones and zeros just to fill the disc up all the way. So the game would load faster, so it would stay towards the center of the disc. That got cracked. There was a boot disc that came out right as I was graduating high school, so this would have been right around 2003, 2004, called the Utopia Boot Disc. And it did exactly that. You would put the boot disc in, turn the console on. It would say, okay, it's okay for you to take the disc out. And then you could put in whatever burned game or whatever region-locked game that you had your access to. And the reason why Sega built the console this way is because they never thought at that time, or maybe they did consider it and they just didn't feel like it was, you know, possible with the technology, was to copy and crack these games. And at the time, there really wasn't. But, you know, once people got into it, especially since it was based on a Windows platform, there's a lot of things you could do when you actually have an OS that is uses familiar technology and verbiage and programming languages that you can program for. Based on that came mod chips. I have a Sega Dreamcast that has a built-in mod chip, so you don't need the Utopia disc anymore, which isn't that big of a deal. But it also gives you access to some other things. You can change Bleem and Bleemcast. So it was kind of similar to basically breaking the games. There was a company called Bleem, and they released a thing called Bleemcast, which was the ability to play PlayStation games on a Dreamcast. And I remember this being a big deal because one of the games that got released on Bleemcast was Metal Gear Solid, which was supposed to be a strict, you know, Sony PlayStation only game. And there's a big legal court case there that I'm sure you can go out and find. There's probably even a gaming historian. I'm sure he did something on Bleem or Bleemcast. And man, if he hasn't, then you should hit him up on Twitter and tell him, hey, gaming historian, we need to know about the Bleemcast. But again, it was just another weird thing. Backwards compatibility, not only from previous consoles of the same manufacturer, but across, you know, console lines. The company created the software and made the discs purely on their own vocation. They broke down the coding and the ways to work without any kind of trademark breaks or anything like that, even though they went under copyright protection because of it. Again, something that was radically different that you just really didn't see. And even now, the Dreamcast is kind of alive today. It has a very big indie scene. There are a lot of games that are being made on PC that are being ported to the Dreamcast. One of those being a little recent, maybe in the past 4 years or so, was Volgar the Viking. Very popular, difficult action, 2D action platformer on PC got ported to the Dreamcast, of all things. And you know what? It plays really, really good. I have a copy of it. There's even games that are homebrew games that are built straight for the Dreamcast. One of those games being Pierre Solar, which is a turn-based RPG that has a huge following. It's a really good game. There's a Turrican kind of successor that got released on it, which the name escapes me, unfortunately. Rush Rally Racing was a game that I really enjoyed that got released just for the Dreamcast. And this is all within the past 10 years. So, like any popular scene, like, there is always a group of people there for that, you know, will enjoy it and that are, you know, trying to do something new with it. So I was thinking to myself before I started getting all my notes down, like, how am I going to end this? What am I going to say that I didn't already say? The Sega Dreamcast, again, still feels like my console. It was like that first console that I got that I was like, man, this is mine. It's nobody else's. This is made for me right now. The game showed that, the innovation showed that, the edginess showed that, the fact that it ended up crashing and burning kind of showed that. It's a console that I always have hooked up to my TV downstairs. It's always ready to play. I have nothing but fond memories of the Sega Dreamcast, playing it with friends and my family, talking about it online and blogs, podcasts like this one. It's sad to see what happened to the console. It only had like 2 years of a life, and then they cut ties. And then now Sega's everywhere. You know, they're on Nintendo consoles, they're on Sony consoles, Microsoft. They're probably going to be on the new Google Stadia streaming platform, whatever you want to call that thing. I don't know. I don't really know. I love it. I love the memes of the Dreamcast 2 is coming out soon, you know. It's thinking. It's just a beautiful tagline for something like this. Like, I felt like it had everything right, and it just didn't work. And unfortunately, that had very little to do with Sega. They were a little ahead of its time when the PlayStation 2 came out and it had a DVD player. I mean, that really was the nail in the coffin for, you know, not only the Dreamcast, but even, you know, partially to the GameCube as well. If Nintendo didn't have their franchises like they do, they would have struggled just as much as Sega did. It's such a weird thing to look back on now of how important it was to have a DVD player. Is kind of like the Netflix, not having Netflix on your console. That's kind of a killer for some people because they can only afford the one thing. And if that thing doesn't do the things that they want, then they just don't do it. You know, it is a huge part of my childhood, regardless of the nostalgia glasses that I wear. And if you haven't experienced the Sega Dreamcast and you've listened to this whole episode, oh my gosh, go out and play it. They're super cheap nowadays. If you want to go the route, you can play the really harder to find games real easy. Just look in the usual places. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Hit me up on Twitter, at Eric Hunter. I will talk Sega Dreamcast and video games with anybody who has a love and fondness for any of that stuff. I hope you enjoy this weird story retelling, you know, kind of live and die of the Sega Dreamcast through the eyes of little Eric Hunter. And if you did, share this episode with others. Share the love. If you would like to support me in the things that I do, check out ericmhunter.net or even my Patreon, patreon.com/ericmhunter, where I release all of my stuff early, then out to the public, give you sneak peeks and all the stuff that I'm working on. And if you are on my Patreon, you know that I'm doing a Sega Dreamcast episode. So tap into that. Until then, everybody, live a happy life. Play the games that you want to play. Stay away from the poison that can be the games industry. And remember, it's always thinking. Thank you for listening through to the end. If you know someone who would benefit from hearing this episode, please tag them in it. Word of mouth is my fire, so light me up.